Welcome to Fried. I'm your host, Kate Donovan. I work with leaders so they can see the patterns that are quietly hurting performance and burning out their best people. In my world, burnout is blameless, burnout is information, and burnout is a signal that we can use to improve workplaces. Seasons 1 through 10 focus on individual burnout. Seasons 11 and beyond focus on leadership, culture, and the workplace. This podcast will help you understand what burnout is pointing to and how to start fixing what's actually causing it. If this is a conversation you feel your organization should be having, that's the work I bring into teams through keynotes, workshops, and advisory. You can find all my info at katedonovan.com. That's CAITDONOVAN.com.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.
Fried fam, the longer this show goes on, the luckier I am to bring people in who I seriously admire and who I never thought I'd ever have a chance of spending time with. And you know that I love to bring people on the show that I've met in real life. And I was lucky enough to meet today's guest just a few months ago at the PwC offices in New York City with Aoife O'Brien when she was doing her book launch. So today's guest is Bhushan Sethi, who is a partner at PwC US Consulting with 25 plus years in workforce strategy in AI-led transformation focused on financial services. A World Economic Forum contributor and a G20 T20 Task Force member, he was honored among the outstanding 50 Asian Americans in business in 2025. His insights on the future of work and AI appear in the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, Bloomberg, and CNBC. He teaches strategy consulting at NYU Stern, and outside work, he is a marathon runner, husband, father, global citizen, and World Cup fan watcher. From what I saw online.
Nice.
Bhushan, welcome to the show.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much, Kate. Great to be with you. Love the intro, and thanks to Aoife for connecting us and, you know, doing the small task of writing a book that we launched and got to have a working session together a few months ago.
Yeah, it was so exciting. And I have to say, you know, I spend a lot of time in the consulting world, mostly because not from your company, but from some of the competitors. I have been burnout coaches for many a consultant in my time. And I haven't met a lot of people who talk openly and freely about work and health balance and inclusivity the way that you do. So I was so refreshed the first day I met you. I was like, oh my God, he's real. There's one out here and he's real. So before we get started, I just wanted to say thank you for taking the stances that you take and showing up the way that you do in the world, because it's impressive and it's heartwarming and it's just a lovely thing to watch. So thank you for that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We all have our triggering events for kind of how we behave. And mine were kind of losing parents and then like focusing on kind of physical well-being as a way to improve kind of mental and spiritual well-being. And the pandemic exacerbated that because we're all in different forms of well-being crisis on different days and weeks and years. And so I think it's a really important part of like our workplace practice, both at an individual and a company level. And I'm sure we're going to get into that in this discussion.
Yeah, we're going to get actually right into that, because you sent to me a T20 policy briefing that you were part of writing recently. And the core argument that comes out of it that I wished that I was in front, you know, like when you make a heart on Zoom, hearts will come out. I kind of wanted to do that as I was reading. I'm going to read the core argument that I was thinking through afterwards. It says, business transformation and competitive pressure are increasing workforce stress and disengagement. We know that. We can pretty much all agree on that. And this is undermining sustainable economic growth. This is the part that no matter how many numbers we seem to put in front of people, we keep not being able to get this message across. Why are we not getting it?
I guess the question there is, who's the we? So if you think about policymakers at a government level, they have to see this data in healthcare spend around the world, and they have to see this in absenteeism in corporations, and we have to see it in what are we doing with our kind of schooling system, et cetera, and kind of burning people out. And there's a ton of data out there around, you know, the happiest countries, take well-being very seriously. Think of your favorite Scandinavian country. They're in that top five, top 10 list. And so we know that. We also learned during the pandemic, and we wrote this policy brief during the post-pandemic, 2023, when the G20 was residing in India. And we basically said, there's a ton of data out there that links investments in physical, financial, and kind of spiritual well-being into GDP growth. And whether you think GDP is the right measure, that's a different podcast we could talk about, Kate. But then what we did is we actually said, we have experience in this area because every time we work on transformations with corporations, what's the reason they fail? The reason they fail is because of people issues. And when you dig a little deeper into that, and this shows up in the work we do even today with AI-led transformation, we're putting a big onus on few individuals. And those few individuals are working their day job, their transformation job, and many organizations today are critically constrained because of, you know, resource capability and capacity. And so there's those types of aspects. And then if you layer on everything that's going on in the world that we can't control in terms of uncertainty and geopolitics, and then the angst and uncertainty that things like AI and tech-led transformation brings to our clients, because let's be honest, everyone's questioning their relevance today. Like, am I going to be good enough? How do I work with the tools if I'm entry level or if I'm a seasoned leader? And so what we need to do is we need to be able to say, how do we get the anxiety out? How do we manage true burnout in terms of workload management? And how do we model this back to what I do every day, work with companies to say, you won't get the returns, however you measure them, financial returns, customer returns, people returns, risk returns, if you don't invest in the well-being of your people. And so the reason I think it's difficult is we haven't created those linkages, and we haven't been able to give people the tools to say, and which is more in your work, like, how do I spot that? What do I do as a leader? What do I do as a team member? And there's many different aspects of well-being. One that we don't actually talk about enough is financial well-being. Mm-hmm. With sticky inflation in the 3-4%, that's a big problem for U.S. employees at every level. And so wherever you look, it could be financial, it could be physical, it could be emotional well-being. But there's a big opportunity still for organizations to optimize their transformation outcomes by focusing on the well-being of their people.
One of the things that came out in this report was that employee burnout is costing approximately $322 billion globally in turnover and lost productivity. And the chronic stress reports go up to $1 trillion in those same measures. So even when chronic stress gets all the way to burnout, it's causing us, you know, a third of $1 trillion.
It is a lot. And the question is, and this is where policymakers and business leaders need to come together, because a business will employ people for a certain amount of time. And we've got to understand, yes, there's different labor laws around the world, but this is your problem while someone is in your employment. But this is society's problem if there's chronic illness. And again, this is more your world than mine. There's chronic illness, or there's chronic stress, or people are not able to work beyond the age of, say, 40, et cetera. Or we've got people leaving the workplace permanently. And this is a big, big issue. And that's why it's important, whether we talk about well-being, whether we talk about upskilling for AI, these are important societal and business topics. And if we don't have policymakers, whatever your politics are, coming together at a national, at a state, at a regional level on these topics with business leaders, we're doing our people a disservice, and we're doing our businesses and our investors a disservice.
One of the recommendations that came out, which I want to say, like, irked me a little, said, create a G20 task force to build a common framework and metrics for well-being. How do we not have, in 2026, a common framework and metrics for well-being? How is it humanly possible that we do not have a common framework and metrics for well-being?
Comes back to incentives and collaboration. Yeah. We don't have, like, just now we're getting together, you know, people around the world are getting together to talk about AI safety standards.
Yeah.
You know, pick your favorite important societal topic, whether it's, you know, ESG, sustainability. Like, we don't have a lot of these things. I remember in 2017, we worked with the World Economic Forum on defining a set of stakeholder capitalism goals that looked at planet and people and prosperity. They never really got implemented in organizations. And these were sponsored by large leaders of big banks and large institutions. And so everything is out there beautifully documented.
Yeah.
But as you know, implementation is hard. And reporting on these things and saying, what action are we going to take to address financial well-being and the level of indebtedness with students coming out of college in the US? Or what are we going to do around true mental health for people that are managing two or three jobs in a rising inflation environment? Or what are we doing for caregivers who can't work remote because there's return to office mandates? Whatever those issues look like, we've got to be able to take action on those, again, at a policy and business level. That's why it's difficult.
What do you see when you're working with a client? What do you see as being the barriers to implementation? I have a friend right now, for instance, who's writing a PhD, and his PhD is on the effectiveness of leadership initiatives, of leadership training initiatives. And he's having a hard time, right? Because of this piece, again, like, are we not making the time for it? Do we not believe that it's... I wrote about this on LinkedIn a while ago. I said, it's not that we don't know what the risks are. We know what the numbers are. Everybody spouts the numbers. We know what the risks are, but it's not encouraging us to take action. It's like when a friend has a health scare and is like, go get checked out. And everybody's like, yeah, but that's your life. It's like the same thing is happening at a macro scale. So what do you see as the barriers to implementation on, like, on the ground, day to day, on a Wednesday at noon, rather than this like high level idea?
To put the topic of well-being and business outcomes on an executive agenda, We need better stories. We need stories to say that return on investment around your big tech investment, the reason why that's delayed 6 months or you're not delivering on the outcomes is not because of the technology. It may not even be because people didn't adopt the system. It might be because 3 to 6 months into that program, you were burning people out. And whether that's workload or whether that's uncertainty, you've asked them to work on something without giving them a good narrative around what their role will be in the future, especially if there's going to be displacements in a certain function of a business. And so data-driven stories are really important. We also need to talk about loss aversion. We also need to talk about the risks of failure in those business cases. And again, in a language that business people will understand in terms of their financials, their return on investments, their customer experience, they're de-risking their business. And we need stories to say, this is what's at risk in terms of the acquisition that we're integrating, the technology that we're implementing, the new products that we're launching, the new business model we're creating, the new global location strategy we're creating. So that's incumbent on us as practitioners, as professionals, as your listeners who are working in functions like HR or business teams. Like, we need better data and we need better stories.
I know that there's a lot of people in the consulting and speaking world that listen to this podcast because of my work. And half of them just pulled their hair out. They're like, we're telling the stories. We're telling the stories. And yet it's still not going all. It doesn't feel like it's going all the way through. And one of the things that I see is that, or my feeling around it is, my background is as a healthcare practitioner. I spent 15 years as an acupuncturist working with patients one-on-one. So I'm coming at everything from that perspective. I know that that is not the perspective of the business owner of the unit owner of whatever problem I'm facing with someone in a company. So are we expecting, and this is a hypothesis that I have, are we expecting leaders to know too much about well-being on top of all the other stuff they already know? Like how much extra pressure are we putting on leaders to understand things that they have no schooling in, no way of knowing? And is this a broken link?
To lead any kind of transformation, and I would even say business as usual, anyone who's running a P&L or a major kind of function today is driving some change in that as well as the business as usual. To be a good transformative leader, you need to focus on powering the engines and the well-being of your people. You need to be incredibly curious. You need to be making sense of the world and what parts of what's changing in the world, even if you can't control it, are impacting the psyche of your employees, the very employees that you need to deliver in a very competitive, uncertain environment, needs to deliver on your transformation goals. So it's incredibly important. It's, you know, we have a framework at the firm called transformative leadership. Those pieces are in there around powering the engines and making sense of the world and being innately curious. So for me, it's table stakes of an effective leader today. And then, Kate, if you layer in the intergenerational components of that, for us to engage Generation Z and millennials, who, especially Generation Z, some of them are coming out, you know, with challenges from COVID because of socialization and schooling. I say that as a parent and also someone who teaches young people. We need to understand that they're not going to tolerate some of the work and the management styles that I personally grew up with when I started work in the UK. And so we've got to, for me, it's table stakes for leaders. And that, and you've got to make that deeply personal to the sector that you're focusing in, the country where you, the teams that you're managing, whether it's a distributed organization, whether it's your employees as well as contractors. But for me, that's an important skill set. Pandemic highlighted it. Yes, it was very divisive and polarizing about vaccinations and mental health. But for me, the ability for people to say, I need some time, or I need some prioritization about my workload, or I'm really stressed about a bunch of things that are happening outside the workplace that I'm bringing into the workplace. And so I think it's okay for people to also share what's on their plate, on their kind of physical plate, their mental plate, you know, with their supervisor, with their colleagues, so that they can actually ask for help and it can be addressed.
Yeah. So I agree that I think that leaders should have this role, that this is table stakes. And if you went to school for finance and then you went and got an MBA and then you did really well as an individual contributor and you got promoted to be a leader, and you were likely untrained to be a leader because most people are, 92% of managers have never been trained to be people leaders. So if we take that, then we're saying that the missing link, the thing that we do not have, is that leaders are not properly and sufficiently skilled at people.
I would say that we're not expecting them to be medical practitioners and to be able to diagnose things on a clinical level. But I think what you and I are talking about is how do you become innately human? In any relationship, we should be able to read the room. We should be able to create an environment where someone can come into your physical or virtual office and say, I'm going to struggle to make this deadline of next quarter or next week. Can we talk about how we resolve it? So I do think all the things that I hear you talk about with your guests here in terms of psychological safety, workload, speaking up, kind of leaders creating room and safe space for people, I think that's all relevant. We're not asking people to be medical experts. I do think everyone should be curious about this from many different lenses, whether you're a parent or a business leader or an employee. But I think we're talking about the human skills.
Yeah. Yeah. The one of the things that I have found over the past 5 or 6 years, something that I've learned, is that sometimes a little bit, a tiny bit of introduction to the medical world, to medical knowledge, a tiny bit, is just enough to make people understand better. Because it's I think it's a big ask, and something that I feel for leaders in this way. Like, I think it's a big ask to ask people to understand other humans while we don't usually understand ourselves well. Like, so this is, it's a lot of self-awareness work. It's a lot of inner work. And not everybody grew up in a space to be able to do that kind of thing. Like you said, we have these new generations coming in. They're coming at things completely different. That shift is going to happen. But I do think that sometimes, I absolutely know this because I've gotten this feedback, that I have explained to people why belonging doesn't work in their organization on a biological level. And they've all been like, oh, okay, now we know how to fix it. Now we know how to override that thing that we're seeing, the conflict that we're seeing. If there's a biological undertone to it, and if you know that, then you can work with it. So I do see like a huge benefit to adding 5% of your knowledge in this way to create that understanding. I've seen that be really effective. But the other thing that you said, and I want to bring up a prior guest, her name is Kristen Scroggin. I don't know if you know Kristen, but she is, her business is called Gen Y Consulting, WHY, and she does generational work. She works a lot with airlines and air companies in general and the government. And one of the things she told me when she was on Fried was that we are prepping for a massive leadership change and sort of none of us are ready for it. So we're looking at what she said is about to happen is boomers are going to be retiring. And then Gen X is going to retire at the same time. And then I'm a geriatric millennial. I'm right at the beginning of the millennial. So it's, I love the term geriatric millennial. I find that real amusing. So I'm a geriatric millennial. So my counterparts out in the world, 44 years old, 45 years old, 43 years old, we're about to, within the next 5 years, become the top leaders at companies because everybody else is going to be gone. How do we do this? How do we make this shift well? What do we do? Bhushan, help us.
So maybe before making the shift, because yeah. I think that shift will be relevant in certain large organizations. The first thing I also see, though, is people leaders are becoming younger.
Yeah.
And so you don't have, like, you could be 23 managing a team, you could be 25, etc. And you don't have the lived experience right. of understanding how to build a room, how to practice empathy, how to deal with difficult conversations, etc. And so I would say that this is not even a generational thing. Mm. We need to be encouraging, and this is where it gets contentious. Your listeners' ears will perk up. Some of the business leaders I work with, kind of they kind of will close their ears. But this is why we need to have safe spaces in organizations to have conversations about social issues, about issues that are really personal to individuals, about people's lived experience, the reason why certain individuals are fearful when they get pulled over by the police, the fact that people are worried about LGBT rights. Like, whatever the issue is, we need to create better conversations in organizations, not to solve them, not to have firms take political stances, but just to be human and just yeah. so that we know and practice our listening skills. We need to do that to rebuild trust in organizations and reduce the polarization, turn down the temperature. Yeah. For me, that's the biggest, most important leadership unlock that we could have in organizations. Create better conversations, create more psychological safety. It's all written about beautifully, Adam Grant, et cetera. But we need to practice it. And I think that's one of the pieces that we, yeah. we need to have. And we could start that today.
Well, I think, I mean, people like you have already started it. I watched you do that in action with your team. I mean, it was obvious right away. And I listened to a podcast that you were on recently, and you said, you know, you grew up in the UK at a time as a, you know, young Indian kid with parents with accents and got treated the way you got treated, and how you've experienced the flip side of it being in the United States with a British accent. And I thought that that was, can you tell people a little bit about that story? Because I think having that level of awareness from both ends of this story is a really fascinating space to show up from.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in the UK, pretty humble beginnings. My parents, they encouraged education like any good immigrant Indian family did, or any immigrant family. I grew up in a very kind of white neighborhood, and we experienced a lot of racism. And And I don't just mean casual racism. And it was like bricks through windows and attacks and bullying, etc. And it's why I love India so much. And it's why I, when people say, you know, are you English? I say, well, I'm Indian, born in London, also an American citizen now, kind of very proud of all three of those, etc. But I came to the US right before 9/11. And my secret sauce was my accent, because the Americans love the British accent. Things sound better, even if they're said by one of my colleagues. You know, I'm not as well educated as people believe, but they kind of believe the words, etc. And now I walk into rooms, and also Indians have a very good reputation here. And I walk in as a British Indian, and because many Indians have done incredibly well in this country, coupled with a British accent, it's opened many, many doors for me in business and in personal life, because people are curious and interested. So, but I'm the same person. I'm the same immigrant kid who grew up experiencing racism, but people treat me in very different ways. And so that's why I really care about this topic, because I've seen it from many angles. And now I'm in a position where I have a platform, and I'm in a position as a business leader in my firm, and someone who influences businesses and policymakers, that I should be bringing that forward for other cohorts and other demographics and other nationalities, because one of the biggest things I hate is intolerance of all kinds. And I just think that we need to have better conversations around that topic too.
Yeah, I think we should be intolerant to intolerance. I agree.
I like that.
One of the things that, and then to me, this goes back. So my brain automatically goes back to the biology and how can I explain this to business people in a way that will make sense to them, right? So one of the things that I teach leaders, I work sometimes with the National Council of Nonprofits and CEOs from nonprofits around the country. That's one of my favorite groups to work with. And one of the things that I teach them is that when you have experienced racism in your life, and then you are at a workplace that maybe is a little more buttoned up and maybe is not as outright as things were 15, 20, 60, whatever, however many years ago, the microaggressions that you experienced actually increase the level of inflammation in your body physically. This is measurable. So when we are talking about increasing tolerance in the workplace, we are also talking about decreasing healthcare costs. People are not being sensitive. Their bodies are physically reacting and we can take their blood and we can measure it. This is not, and sometimes hearing it from this perspective, I've had people do exactly what you're doing now and go, yup, like that makes sense to me. I can understand that. So they are less likely, the next time they overhear a little dig, they're less likely to let it go, because there's more of a connection to like, what's actually happening in this moment to this person? Can they just brush it off? Even if the person is able to brush it off with language, their bodies are still reacting. So I feel like this, I love this idea of we need to bring this humanness like really strongly into leadership right now to sort of counteract AI and to make sure we're ready for the next generation. And I think as part of that humanness, we have to remember that we are bodies and they are reacting to things around us, no matter what our face or attitude or words say. I think I just find that to be really important. But again, that's my world.
And a great example of where you need to find people in other disciplines that are far smarter than you to educate you as a leader, because I didn't know about the biology and the inflammation and the inflammation that would be driven. I knew about kind of the emotional and the psychological consequences, but that's fascinating.
Right.
Again, we need to encourage that. We need to encourage people to ask questions, and people that do have knowledge that they're not practicing in their daily work to bring that to the table.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I love so much. Okay, the other thing that I wanted to talk to you about today is, gosh, we are afraid of AI and we also love it and hate it all at the same time. We have fear, we have anxiety, we have adoration, we have relief, and we have despise, all for the same tool, right? Like all at the same time. And it goes everything from I might lose my job to we are killing the planet to life is going to be easier. And we can't seem to figure out which one should be first in the list. As someone who is at the forefront of AI implementation in the workplace, how do you see this affecting people? And what is one thing that we can focus on to do it well as we move forward?
So the one thing I would say for all the AI, everyone who's practicing any part of AI today, is ask your company what their AI narrative is. And what I mean by that is, how are we thinking about AI, whether it's how we think it about compute power today, how we think it about measuring return on investments, what are we going to do with some of those returns? Is it going to be reinvested in growth and development of people and new business models and revenue streams? Or are we going to take some out to actually improve profitability in the short term? And if we do that, how do we do that in a humane way? So everywhere I look, and I spend lots of time with different companies and executive teams on this topic, when I ask them, what is your narrative? If one of your managers, one of your employees asks, how are we thinking about compute, job loss, job impacts, building even things technically, like, are we going to build agents using a third party kind of LLM? Are we going to take them embedded from the technology? People are asking all of these questions. And just like any transformation, if you don't create the narrative, someone else will create it for you. Could be your activist investors. It could be media. It could be your employees. It could be your competitors. And so the firms that do this well, they have speaking points on these and they're genuine.
Yeah.
And many of them could be, we don't know, but here's how we're thinking about compute power today and the environmental effects. Here's how we're thinking about token usage versus labor costs. Here's how we're thinking about giving people access to tools and training so that even if we do need to make some transitions out, we're equipping people with the skills. And some of the biggest challenges in organizations around this AI narrative is when they have two tiers of workers, those digital knowledge workers who are practicing having access to the tools, and then maybe they have some manufacturing workers or essential retail workers in the same organization that their jobs are labor intensive and they don't have the ability to build those skills. And if we don't give access to tools and upskilling there, as those jobs will become more with physical AI or more automated, those people get left behind, whatever country you're looking at. And so the narrative is really important.
This is actually really interesting because when I'm not working with nonprofits, I spend a lot of time in the FMCG world. And that is the thing that I've heard almost all the leaders that I've spoken to over the past 18 months in this world have said. We've been told to just play with AI, like just sort of play with it and like see what you create. There is zero narrative. There is zero directive. There is no training. They're just like, we're not really sure. Like, FAFO, like go mess around and see what happens. And that has felt, I haven't had a good sort of comeback for that. But this idea about having a strong AI narrative, even if it's including the I don't knows, and maybe even especially if it's including the I don't knows, is really appealing to me. Are there more examples of narrative pieces that you can give us so that if there's like, you know, somebody, a leader listening right now, and they're like, oh, I don't know what I would say about that. Are there some sort of things that you've been hearing that you're like, this one's not bad. This is probably good. You mentioned a few already, but I'm wondering if you have a couple more up your sleeve.
What I would share is I was running a working session with a large financial institution with some of their leaders a few months ago. And I wanted to start this with something pithy that they would remember. And so I said, look, there's a lot of noise around AI. There's a lot of noise around kind of how you got to think, what are the skills, et cetera. And I said, there's three things that I want you to remember in terms of having an AI mindset. You got to think differently. One is you got to think like an economist. Mm. You've got to really be discerning. You've got to look at all the inputs, all of the estimates on what AI is going to do to jobs, what AI is going to do to driving GDP, you know, in the economy. You've got to look at all those reports, but you've got to think like an economist and think about the assumptions because that's going to be relevant to your organization. Mm. And you've also got to practice discernment there. Don't believe all of the research that you read. Every research written has their own incentives, including those that are produced by consultants.
Right.
The second one is you've got to think like a scientist. You've got to be able to run experiments. You've got to think about what we're testing, how we're measuring that. You've got to have the creativity and the curiosity. You've got to think like a scientist and as an innovator. And the third one is think as a humanist. So all of this is great in terms of like, you think it like an economist, you think like a scientist, you run the experiments, But humans is where this thing kind of lands and where this thing gets amplified. Like, are people going to, everything we talked about, are we going to provide the psychological safety? Are people going to adopt? Are we going to get people to reimagine their work? Are people going to redesign processes that put themselves out of a role so that the firm can reinvest that and they can build new skills and the firm can drive better outcomes? So a very simple framework around an economist, a scientist, and a humanist, and you can apply that in any different way. So it's just a different play on the narrative. It's more giving people a way to think about this.
I like that a lot. I'm going to go back to the paper for a moment. One of the things that came up was encouraging businesses to publicly disclose well-being data. Now, my sister is a chief people officer, and I can just imagine, I'm going to call her after we finish and ask her what she thinks about this. I think she would be for it because I'm her sister. And so, you know, that kind of drives some of that. But do you think that this a statement like this instills fears in leaders and C-suites?
Yes. The only way you drive demonstrable change, whether we like it or not, is to start measuring it and disclosing it. And that can't be done at an individual company by company level. It has to be through a regulatory body or a government body, et cetera. In the same way that safety incidents are reported and tracked, or customer complaints are evaluated in certain, you know, in regulatory bodies in the US around financial services. So that was the purpose of that, because from my experience, and I did a lot of work with banks during the 08 crisis, banks had to start reporting on things like culture and employee complaints and customer complaints and the safety and soundness of their organization long after they had remediated some of their control failures. And so from my experience, it's not fun, it's not sexy, but disclosures and getting people to report, and we know people that can gain, you can gain reports, etc. But the significance, the symbolic need around disclosures is why we made that recommendation. And no, it hasn't been implemented, but it needs to be done, you know, at a country regional level.
Yeah. And before that, right, you have to have the common framework and the metrics that has to be decided on, because you can't report on something that doesn't have a way to be measured, right? The other thing that I liked was this, the last recommendation, which was find a way to incentivize businesses to be first adopters via recognition funding and partnerships. This to me is that going back to those questions I was asking you earlier, like how do we get people to actually move forward on these things? And I think this is it. When we're talking about a business, I mean, money is the driver. We want it to be people. It's people say sometimes it's people, but stakeholders are stakeholders, and the stock market is the stock market. And I'm invested in it, so I'm part of this machine as much as anybody else is. I love this idea. Do you see like the best places to work awards and things like that being part of this, or do you see a new system for it?
When you look at companies that have very strong cultures, they self-report some of their success stories. And so this is in the public, this is in the public domain. Synchrony offers training for nursing degrees to some of its associates. They're not in the healthcare nursing business, but they do it because it's the right thing for the US. And to the extent that those roles get transitioned at some point, those people have a career in something that is in demand in the US. There are other organizations that are offering retraining for things that are not relevant to their business. Mm-hmm. From my perspective, this is where, again, policymakers and businesses need to come together to say, let's solve the common problem of workforce transition and people needing to work in careers that are in demand. Healthcare is an example, but it also could also be construction. It could also be plumbing is the great example that we always hear. But that's some of the pieces that are really needed.
What would be your, I'm trying to think of exactly how I want to ask this question. You have quite a few years before retirement ahead of you. Let's say you're getting to the point of retirement. what would make you feel most proud to have influenced? You've done a lot of work, and you're in a big space making a lot of impact. So what do you feel like will make you feel the proudest when you get to the point of retirement? I mean, clearly you're only 22, so it's going to be a long time.
From my perspective, the more that business leaders like myself can actually be much more vocal on topics where they have domain expertise and bring that either to the policy arena, back to businesses, whether they're on boards or whether they're consultants who advise, or whether they're coaches to other leaders. Like, I'm talking about things that I would not talk about if I was 25 years old. Like, yeah. I'm talking about inclusion and well-being and ROI at risk if you don't invest in well-being and psychological safety. And these things, people roll their eyes, Kate, people, you've seen this, you know, people will call us woke. People will say we're very soft and there's no ROI in this. And that's absolute nonsense. And it's going to be even more important with our children's generation. You know, I have three of them and they're going to be entering the workplaces, you know, before I know it. And so it's getting people to who have had lived experiences to say, yesterday's playbook will not work anymore. We're not going to drive all of the brilliant promise of AI and reinventing business models if we don't bring people along. And one thing that scares me massively is the polarization of them and us. It shows up in many different ways with protests and different views. And no one can have a reasonable conversation back to we need better conversations. But also income inequality is growing in this country and around the world. It's those types of issues that people like myself and others need to be bringing to the table. And there are some great examples of CEOs who are doing this and people that run foundations that are doing this and billionaires that are doing this. So this isn't a, you know, business leaders are not doing this. I just think more and more regular business leaders, if that's what I'll call myself, should be doing this at the ground level, not people who run foundations or CEOs of massive institutions.
Yeah, we can use them as wonderful examples, but then we need to model that behavior. Massive shout out to Diane Yentl, who is the CEO of the National Council of Nonprofits out of DC, who has been fighting the good fight over the past couple of years in a way that has put her life at danger. And that's, I'm not saying everybody needs to go that far. I know that's a risk that she's taking, but this is a time that we have the opportunity to use a voice. And if we have people that can be that model for us, I think that we need to stand up and show up and respect that and do the best we can within the spaces that we own to make those same promises. Another shout out I will give on this topic is Owen Fitzpatrick. He's a speaker and author consultant who just wrote a book called Inner Propaganda. And it's about learning how to have better conversations, to discern better, to believe better. That's his thing, is belief leadership, how to influence better, how to understand the stories running your own mind so that you can influence your own self better. And I think that the level, the depth to his work and the leaders that he's working with, I think that that's the space that we're seeing change. We have to do a certain level of internal work before some of this comes out alive. It's hard to get through to be that transformational leader, like you were saying earlier, without actually transforming.
Absolutely. And then one thing to add to this is, because people will be listening to this to say, oh, this all sounds very like perfection and a playbook. But the people that I'm saying should be involved are the very people like myself who've made a ton of mistakes in these areas in the past.
Yeah.
Like in my 20s, I was not as inclusive. I kind of was very kind of type A in terms of charging hard and pushing people in terms of deadlines. I think like the polarization issue was just not on my radar screen. And I was also worried about my own career and kind of what people might say. Yeah. And now I feel it's like a right responsibility, a passion. People listen. And so I will continue to share in an inclusive, responsible way. I'm still a red-blooded capitalist. I believe in business and business outcomes. I just think that there's an opportunity for us to bring it all together, and business and workforce outcomes are intertwined. But I just want everyone to know, like, I speak this way and learn this way by making a ton of mistakes and learning from them.
Yeah, I mean, amen to all of us doing being on that road. Bhushan, is there anything left that you'd like to share before we wrap up?
I just say, I mean, your listeners are focused on burnout and whether they're advising leaders, organizations, or kind of focusing on themselves. I would just say that, you know, I listened to one of the previous podcasts you had with Dr. Natalie Nixon, great book and great speaker, but the something that you could invest in to kind of center yourself. For me, it's running. And I started running after, you know, one of my parents died, and I run 17 marathons, and it's my thing. And it's something I try and do every day, even if it's just a couple of miles or 5 miles, etc. But you got to find one thing that you do to center yourself. It could be going for a walk. It could be calling your mom, whatever it is, just find one thing and your day becomes better. So that would be my advice. Everyone should just focus on what their one thing, their one daily habit, and it will be very personal. Mine's running.
Bhushan, thank you so much for the time that you took. I know that you have a big, busy schedule, and I'm really appreciative of having the chance to talk to you. Thank you so much for being here. Fried fam, the reason that I wanted to bring Bhushan to you today is because I need you to understand that when you say that people are not talking about this, people are not doing the work, you don't trust the leaders to step in, you don't, there are people doing the work that are invested in it, that do think it's important, that are speaking up about it. We are not out there alone. Your leaders are not trying to abandon you. There is somebody out there that is fighting the good fight. So I'm trying to bring to you as many examples as I can find, so that you start to believe that this is true, so that you can start to dig into the way that you want to show up, that you want to lead, that you want to treat yourself and your people. If you found this episode useful, the thing that we need you to do most is leave us a review and then share it with whoever you thought about while you were listening to it. That helps us meet the most people and helps us to hashtag end burnout culture. Thanks for being here, and I'll see you next week.